Hello, and welcome back to Hemophilia and Young Adulthood, a three-episode podcast series presented by Bloodstream Stories. I'm Patrick James Lynch, but you should already know that because this is episode two of Hemophilia and Young Adulthood. So if you got here without listening to episode one, you're magic, but you're also lost, and we need to send you back to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, or go to bloodstreampod.com so that you can download Bloodstream's Hemophilia and Young Adulthood episode one. And while you're there, you may as well subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast. It can't hurt. Maybe even leave a review, share the link with a friend, just a couple ideas. For the previously initiated who did listen to episode one, again, welcome back. Thanks for coming back. And thanks as well to Takeda for originally making this discussion and series possible, and to Hanjay for being an excellent partner in producing this special event. Reminder that next Monday, July 15th, will be the flagship episode of the Bloodstream podcast, co-hosted by Natalie and me, and the third and final episode of Hemophilia and Young Adulthood goes up on Monday, July 22nd. Of course, the easiest thing to do is to subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast on wherever you listen to podcasts, as that'll just deliver the fresh new episodes right on over to you. Of course, you can also search the episodes tab on bloodstreampod.com or freak out on us on Facebook or on Twitter if you have trouble finding any of the episodes. And with that, please enjoy the episode you have found, episode two of Hemophilia and Young Adulthood, presented by Bloodstream Stories. Hello, and welcome to part two of Bloodline's Hemophilia and Young Adulthood Roundtable Discussion, brought to you by Bloodstream Media and Believe Limited. This first-of-its-kind podcast series was produced in partnership with the Hemophilia Association of New Jersey, or HANJ, and its members, and was made possible by Shire. I'm Patrick James Lynch, joined once again by my co-host and champion, Natalie Lynch.
Hello.
Hello. How are you, Natalie?
I'm good.
And Natalie, in part one of this series, we explored the themes of identity, disclosure, and transition. And we heard some interesting stories.
Yeah, each of our four men with hemophilia offered some really valuable perspectives, as did their four champions. And they have some great points to make in this episode, too, especially around the topic of pain management and substance abuse, which isn't always the easiest topic to discuss.
It's certainly not. So we'll jump back into the roundtable discussion here, but first a quick moment to talk about the Bleeding Disorders Community Facebook page. Life with a bleeding disorder can be challenging. You know that?
I sure did.
It can be, even for the caregivers, right, Natalie? That's why Shire created the Bleeding Disorders Community Facebook page. The Bleeding Disorders Community Facebook page provides useful information and an encouraging community for people living with or caring for someone who has a bleeding disorder. Visit facebook.com/bleeding disorders community today to connect with others and help take control of your bleeding disorder.
Now for part two of the Hemophilia and Young Adulthood Roundtable, where we focus on the themes of pushing limits, emotional support, pain management, and substance abuse.
I was in high school. I think that's where it affected me the most. That's when you begin to explore your surroundings and things like that. In high school, that's when I felt more of a normal person, let's say. And I didn't, that it was an issue as well, though, because I kind of ignored my hemophilia and set it aside and said, okay, let me just live a normal life, which you shouldn't do. So as Stephanie said, you have to keep yourself involved in the community, hemophilia community, realize that you're still a hemophiliac. It's not going to go away, although I'm still living the life of a normal person, very active, doing a lot of stuff that I'm not supposed to be doing.
Well, this is getting interesting. So what are you doing that? Well, actually, let's talk to your wife. Well, what's he doing that he's not supposed to be doing?
Something that Mr. Bombardier, I can't pronounce his last name.
Bombardier, Chris Bombardier.
Yes, Chris. I followed him on Facebook throughout his journey and his adventure, and I was very excited. It kind of motivated me to do something similar to what he did. I even told my wife, she's in disagreement.
Disagreement about your going to climb Mount Everest?
Yes.
Is that what you're telling me?
But obviously, I don't think I'll do it. I don't think I'm in the physical condition that Chris is. I mean, that requires a lot of practice. But anyways, I'm jealous because just watching him do that, I'm like, wow, that was incredible.
So I want to hear from your wife's perspective. Yomara, am I saying that correctly?
Yes, that's right.
Juan's referring to activities that he, quote, should not be doing. And this idea of should and should not be doing and what is or is not appropriate for someone with hemophilia is a really interesting topic. So from your perspective, what is he referring to? And do you agree or disagree that he should not be doing these activities?
He was referring to being active. We work out, we go to the gym at least 5 times every week, and we try to stay eating healthy, doing things. We like to go out, walk, run, rock climbing, things like that. The condition, it also relies on your mind. Like, it's a condition that if you feel like you're capable, you cannot stop doing the activities that you really enjoy doing. The years that we've been married, to be open about hemophilia, have the time to speak about any fears that we have. And I believe having an open conversation is what makes our relationship successful.
I used to practice boxing.
So okay, now we're veering into the should not territory, but go ahead.
So boxing, I did that many for maybe 4 years. We will gather my friends and we will go to an actual gym, and obviously they'll make you sign an agreement, liability and all that. And so that's when I would get nervous. And
rightfully so.
Yes, I would. But the craziest thing is that I wasn't infusing.
Wow, this is a very interesting group. Used to teach boxing?
Yes, that's how I met my wife.
Well, this just gets more and more interesting as we go. Wow. So you used to teach boxing.
I used to teach a boxing boot camp on a weekly basis, and my wife decided to show up. Well, at the time, she was just someone that went to the gym.
Right.
And then she ended up wanting to do some private sessions, and here we are, 8 years later.
And you both use the term used to box. So you tried it out, and then you decided.
I actually recently started doing it again.
Yeah. Oh, boy. But, you know, I think it also depends on, like, how you identify with it, because when I met my husband, he wasn't really identifying himself as a hemophiliac, even though he's very moderate. He's had some serious issues because of it. When we were deciding to get serious and we decided to move in together, he had disclosed it to me. And I think he initially thought that maybe it would scare me away, but it actually had the opposite effect on me. Like, I work in healthcare, I'm familiar with hemophilia. So when he told me, I kind of was on the opposite end of the spectrum, where I kind of took on that nurturing role. And I was like, okay, well, you have hemophilia and you don't want to say that you have hemophilia, you don't want to take it seriously, but I feel that you need to identify with it and take it seriously. So, I mean, we live a very wonderful life and we love to travel and we like to experience new things, but I kind of brought him down to earth and I'm like, listen, you want to do all these things, I'm going to be the one that's making sure you have your travel letter when we go on vacation, making sure you have all the supplies and medications, you know, kind of making sure that you're doing activities that are safe for you but still having fun.
I was capable of making those decisions prior. just to make on record. But in college, I mean, Isaiah and Justin, as you guys said, I was a mess. I was a hot mess. I was in a fraternity. I got hurt. I drank. I partied. I did all that college cliche stuff. And I was a mess before I met my wife. So I guess that's to say a lot, because today I am very grounded with her. So I'm very appreciative.
That is the transition from college to jobs to intimate relationships. Once you leave your parents' house and you go to college, there's considerations. And once you leave, you know, the nest of college and then move on to life outside that, you're going to push limits and maybe go to the boxing gym. I don't suggest that, but, you know, but sometimes you have to do that to learn that that's where the limit is. Mm-hmm. And it all plays into the comprehensive impact of having hemophilia.
Oh, that was very clever. Okay, so let's go into that topic. Next topic being the comprehensive impact, not just a physical, but also a psychological disorder. And a couple of our questionnaires reflected that. I think actually, Raj, you may have been one of the two people who identified that as something that maybe isn't talked about enough, is the mental component of what it is to live with hemophilia. So let's start with that mental, that psychological, emotional aspect of it. How has hemophilia impacted you on a mental and emotional level?
It does get stressful because now I travel for work and stuff like that. And I guess just the psychological stress behind thinking, am I going to have enough factor? What happens if, I don't know, anything happens? I fly out of the country for work, so anything could happen. Is a hemophilia treatment centers, like, that little stresses, I guess, could sometimes stress me out, just because I'm thinking, you know, I don't know, do I have enough life insurance to cover me? Like, little things like that. I mean, it's
no, but it's fair.
It's something that's not talked about.
It's life insurance cover dune buggy flips.
You know, someone that has, you know, hemophilia, and then in terms of injury and risk And I feel like for a while mentally, we're in a higher risk category.
We've seen some needs assessments and some surveys done that suggest that the mental burden that hemophilia presents is something that is not handled to the degree maybe that it should be within our community.
So I, again, just growing up with it, not knowing until 14, and then having to face hemophilia alone. I was born and raised here in New Jersey, but my father was not from here. Did not know what it was, had a little bit of a challenge understanding it, didn't have the mother, didn't really have other family members involved at that time. Hmm. So it was very difficult in terms of a mental perspective as a young 14-year-old trying to figure out what this is. And although we have some great resources, those resources are very limited in those treatment centers where the social worker does come in and they do their own assessment. And not to say that our current social worker, that the place I go to, is doing a bad job, but at the same time, I don't know if they're able to mentally grasp that because them themselves do not have hemophilia. So that's a topic that needs to be discussed. You know, how do you go about it? You need these emotional supports that you need to be able to talk through some of the things that are not talked about. Even for those going through it by themselves, I feel like that probably will be harder for them to transition.
When you referenced the Blood Brotherhood a couple times, and obviously the organization here, I think these organizations are in part to help reduce that isolation and that and those feelings of aloneness.
I'll be honest, as a guy going to one of these things for the first time, it was just weird for me to have a group of men sit together and talk about this.
Sure.
And it was just like, because it wasn't the group of friends that I grew up with. And, you know, it's not like everyone has this professional background in him. It's just people with it, kind of like a support group kind of thing.
Right.
And that's where I felt, I guess, as an adult, it was more accepting to understand that support group setup. But as it was presented to me as a young individual in college, like, oh, go hang out with a bunch of guys and talk about it. I just thought.
Talk about your emotions all day about
talk
it.
Talk about your emotions.
Maybe cry a little.
It felt weird.
Yeah. Well, that's
not normal in my realm, just to like talk things out. And I think for a lot of guys, that's where the mental health stuff comes in.
Sure.
Because it's like, do you talk about your feelings?
Well, that's interesting because that kind of present. I'd be curious to hear maybe Isaiah from you next on this topic. But just on that, like, as guys, do you talk about your feelings? I think there is a thing as guys where, you know, we don't, or culturally it's not expected and we shouldn't. And then on top of that, I don't know where your dad's from or your family's, you know, culturally, where your background's from. You mentioned being from Colombia, and I know in Southern California, where we're based out of, one of the challenges with a very large Latino contingency there is, and this has been articulated to me by members of the Latino hemophilia community, is this sense of machismo and macho, and you don't show weakness, you don't let anyone see you down, and that inhibits people from sharing how they're feeling. But that's a cultural barrier, and that's really challenging to overcome. Where have you found your psychological, mental, emotional support as a man with hemophilia?
Well, for me, it was growing up, I went to camps that support children with different disorders and illnesses that included hemophilia. And my brother, my oldest brother, who also has it, he was there my first year. So he got me sort of used to the whole being away from home and being around other people who also had different disorders and hemophilia. So that was like where I would go like every summer for a week and basically find people who were like me who had hemophilia.
And that helped you find that support that you needed to
maybe
emotionally feel a little more secure, so to speak, as someone with hemophilia.
It was different because it was only for a week, and because like once I left camp, I really didn't talk about it anymore. But it was nice to know that other people had it and like be around people who understood what hemophilia was.
Justin, you were a camper yourself as well. Do you relate to some of what Isaiah just shared?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Just in general, I went to Hole in the Wall Gang Camp from the age of 12. I actually started going to those camps a little bit later. I know most people start going like when they're very young. And luckily enough, I already had lots of emotional support from a young age. But I hadn't really had any from around like my age group itself. So going to these camps and just meeting other hemophiliacs, hearing their stories, just hearing that teenage adolescent perspective was something very different and very enlightening to hear. Another interesting point I wanted to bring up in terms of being in touch with your emotions and masculinity. In my family, I am the only male with a bleeding disorder, but I have two females in my family, my mother and my sister, who have bleeding disorders. My mom has von Willebrand's and my sister has a platelet dysfunctionality.
That's nice. You guys got like a little spectrum covered within the family. Look at
and,
you.
And I find that the reason why I may be more in touch with my emotions and vulnerability is because I was raised by women who also have bleeding disorders. And I feel like that might be a factor in that. Maybe if it was another male with a bleeding disorder in the family, that I wouldn't be as in touch with my emotions. I might have been taught to hide it a little more because maybe their perspectives were different, that rubbed off on me as well.
That's a very intelligent insight. I wonder about that myself too, because I was raised by my mother and my grandmother, and my grandmother especially was effusive and loving and a lot of emotion. So I got very comfortable to a point where I don't stop talking, which is, you know, a different kind of problem. But I've often wondered that myself, if that had a role to play.
This special young adult roundtable discussion and Bloodline podcast series is only made possible due to the support from Shire. So allow me a moment to share with you about bleedingdisorders.com. They offer resources and support designed for people living with a bleeding disorder.
That's applicable.
Yeah. You'll find everything from information on sports and exercise.
That's good.
To tips about finding a local HTC while you're away at school.
Oh, that's appropriate.
As well as Shire's programs and services for the bleeding disorders community.
Fantastic.
Visit bleedingdisorders.com
when?
Today.
Okay.
Well, yeah, today. Or right. Tomorrow. You know, I don't want to be
tomorrow.
Pushy. To find useful tools and resources. That's bleedingdisorders.com. Thank you, Shire.
Thank you, Shire.
And now back to our discussion.
In terms of physical pain, we all know that there's acute and chronic pain. When you have hemophilia, there's the bleed pain, there's long-term pain. But I think we want to next talk a little bit about pain management and the various ways in which we manage our pain.
Sure, we'd love to go around and just ask individually, what do you do to manage your pain, whether it's an individual bleed, acute, or chronic pain? We can start with one.
Just by talking about pain management, I was actually doing I was working at a security firm, doing security, and I was just sitting there monitoring 120 DVRs, and all of a sudden my elbow starts bleeding rapidly. It's like one of those bleeds that you get, and all of a sudden in 30 minutes you're already hurting. And you're like, oh God, what am I supposed to do? Am I going to just leave this site and call it in? I'm just going to suck it in. Go to the bathroom, get the cold water running, and just put my elbow inside the sink. Fill it up with water, get the elbow inside the sink, and let it soak, and hopefully that'll make me, and that's what I use to help me, to be honest with you.
When you get spontaneous bleeds at work?
Yeah.
Okay, that works.
Just, the time that I wasn't relying on Factor, me being ignorant at the time.
Being resourceful of what's available.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. And Raj, how do you manage your pain?
I try to meditate. Typically, I approach a very holistic approach. I do yoga in terms of, like, if there's a bleed. It's just good for your body. It just restores how your body's feeling. Are you talking about pain management in terms of, like, do I take, like, Tylenol?
I'm talking about, I love your, as a yoga teacher, I love your answer.
I told her, I was like, you know, well, after everyone answers, we'll talk about alternative forms like yoga,
meditation.
Yoga, meditation.
He's like, no. Well, that'll be something we can bring up after.
I actually
thank you.
My recent trip, some incense for just meditating and stuff like that.
We'll talk off mic about
but yes,
all, yeah, all of
yeah,
it. What
I'm
do
familiar
you do?
With the ice method, right? It's ice compress, elevate. So my target joint is not my elbow, it's my knee, it's my right knee. In terms of pain management, I think now there's more holistic approaches that are unconventional. I guess not as widely accepted, per se.
Mm-hmm. But you find them to be effective.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is the appropriate form for
it absolutely
for
is,
talking yeah. about that, but I did see that on the list of things. The meditation is definitely something different. I definitely don't recommend doing any drugs. Or, you know, illicit drugs, definitely in terms of just regular pain management, just being aware of where your pain's coming from and being able to just sit back and say to yourself, all right, I need to take a break. I need to rest. I need to elevate. All right, I need to remove myself from your current situation and that's causing you pain.
I think that can be the hardest part sometimes, is the recognition that I just need to stop what I'm doing right now, because that can often be the hardest part, especially in college, especially not wanting to remove myself from what was going on because something's going on and I have to treat. Or if I'm running late in the morning and I haven't infused when I'm supposed to and I got a full day ahead of me, but I don't want to miss anything, that just slowing down to truly assess what's going on, because it's easy enough to, okay, I've got the acronym of ice in my head, I have Tylenol here, I have an ace bandage, there's an ice bucket over there. But if you're not stopping to take inventory and actually give yourself the opportunity to take care of yourself, none of that knowledge is really that useful.
I heard Raj speak about the ice method. When I was at camp, a few more letters added to that.
Oh.
We had the rice, which is to at rest. And now I learned about price, which is prevention.
Oh, I don't know price. Okay. Wow, we're really like stretching this out, huh?
Yeah.
Love it.
So that's kind of what I was trying to do when I was growing up. Sort of like not to take the risk that will get you injured in the first place. But when I get hurt, you know, lie down, keep your legs up, use some ice. That's basically what I did, like, once I got, like, a bleed or I started injured.
And what about for you, Justin? Anything that hasn't been mentioned that you have found effective in managing your pain?
Well, for me, I don't treat prophylactically. I treat on demand. So that means I cannot treat preventively. Everything is after the fact. So not in the literal definition of the term, but every bleed for me is spontaneous in the fact that it's really never in the same place. I don't have a target joint, and I don't get accustomed to the pain of having bleeds. I can sometimes go 6-7 months without having a bleed, and then I might have them like bang, 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 all in a row, maybe like 2 or 3 in a month. So it's kind of like the feeling of pain is new every time. I can't exactly get used to it, and that makes it tougher in a sense. And to get through that, I just kind of remember that there's good periods where luckily that I won't have pain for a long time, and sometimes there's going to be bad periods where I will. And with that routine, I can get very accustomed to having the routine I'm in with no pain and no bleeds for 6-7 months at a time. And then all of a sudden, I just have to transition into a different state where I'm in pain and I have to completely disrupt the flow of the entire life that I've been living for such a long time. So I just have to remember that there's just some good periods and there's some bad periods, and that helps me get through the pain I'm feeling in that moment.
Jonathan James lives in Louisiana and has severe hemophilia. He has the organization Hope for Hemophilia. He'll talk about the seasons that you go through when you live with hemophilia. There are good seasons and there are bad seasons. And, you know, for him, Hope for Hemophilia is supposed to be there when you're in a bad season. So something I'll kind of keep going along these lines. Something that we have an issue with as a nation, unfortunately, and our population isn't excluded from it. You mentioned illicit drugs earlier, is the abuse of prescription pain medication. And unfortunately, our community has lost people, lost young people who have used, abused prescription drugs, alcohol, and some sabotaging ways of trying to self-medicate or treat. I'm curious, has anyone here, and you know, I'll raise my hand, but is there anyone else here who's been drawn to any of these less than healthy methods of treating pain in their lives? Good. So only a handful. We're kind of split. No one will know yet whose hands have gone up because this is an audio thing. But for those of us who have, and I'm not surprised that it's those of us in our late 20s and early 30s and not those of us who are on the younger end. And I don't know about you guys. I've lost friends. I've lost loved ones to these problems. And like we said earlier, if it was a simple thing to deal with, we wouldn't be talking about it. But what can we do as individuals? What can we do as a community so that we are helping to reinforce things like, say, yoga, meditation, acupuncture, rest, hydration, one of the most overlooked aspects of health, so that people are living healthier lives and maybe aren't as compelled to go to these areas that can be particularly problematic?
I don't think that more holistic approaches are mainstream enough. Like, they're not talked about. And when you go to see a physician, like, that's not the first thing that they recommend to you. It's always something pharmaceutical. And, you know, I see that firsthand because I work in the industry. But I think if they made more awareness of other approaches to dealing with pain management, that maybe people would be more open to trying it. But I think, like with Raj and I, because we're together, you know, we do yoga together. Like they were saying, they like to go to the gym together and be active. When you have a support system and someone else is doing it with you, we've noticed that yoga has helped him so much with his joints and mobility that, like, he doesn't even want to take even Tylenol for pain. He would rather just rest or do something, you know, active but gentle that's not as high intensity. But I think that a lot of people don't know, and then it's not recommended to them, you know, by medical professionals that they're supposed to trust. So they don't think to do that. They just think, oh, take this pill and my problem will go away. But to me, it makes it even worse.
But some people have to go through that journey, and it's unfortunate that people resort to things like that. And a lot of it is, it's psychological, it's mental, and it's sad because there's so many things that we can do as a community and as individuals and as champions and as parents and, you know, to help those individuals that are going through something like that.
Stephanie, from your perspective as executive director of a patient organization, what are your thoughts on this? And to the point of, what do you think we can do as a community to try to combat this issue?
I think having discussions like this, I think breaking that mold and the silence of the topics at hand. There is a huge problem nationwide with opioids and this concept of, you know, I think sometimes people think, well, I don't have addiction in my family, so I'm in a little bit of pain and the doctor prescribed me this, I should be fine. And it's actually those folks that you're seeing are actually going down that road and they're like, I don't know how I got here. So I think having discussions, having people that you can call, you know, and I could say at HA&J, we have gotten phone calls from folks that even though they had a support system, or it looks on the outside like they have a support system, they felt alone in certain moments. And we happen to be the people that they called. And at HA&J, we always try to be that soft place for people to land and a resource. And they know that we'll advocate for them and give them a voice when they feel they don't have it. But I would have to second everybody else's ideas of holistic approaches. You know, I think opening up that discussion as well of meditation. I'm a big fan of meditation, and I never thought I could get to a point where I could meditate. And the moment that I did and how I felt afterwards was so moving, actually, that it made me continue to learn how to meditate in different ways. And now I can meditate in my car driving to work if I need to, which you wouldn't think that that would be a moment where you could meditate because you're driving, but you can. Like, our mental state of mind and our brains are so strong and powerful. So if we were to understand that and be able to, like I said, have these kinds of discussions, I think that that's a good start. And I think it would help tremendously.
And I think you raise a good point, too, about, you know, well, my doctor prescribed it. Well, alcohol is legal. You know, just because something is legal or prescribed by a doctor, it still can be dangerous. And I think that that's a conversation that has to be had, too. Like, oh, I have a bleed. I'm just going to pour myself, you know, a small glass of whiskey and I'll just feel much better. I won't feel anything. And it's that can be a slippery slope. Like opioids, and you know, there are alternatives that should be talked about and shared and encouraged.
Definitely.
But just before we leave this topic, because we do have one parent who's at the table and we're talking about things that I think are on parents' minds when they have children in high school, children in college, children out of the house. And I know it's something my mom always worried about with me. So I'm curious to know from you, Janet, when it comes to these unhealthy ways of treating pain, did you ever have any concerns with any of your boys for any particular reason? And how did you as a parent navigate that?
Although I don't have any concerns about Isaiah misusing anything or doing anything inappropriate to control his pain management or any aspect of his bleeds, I really do not worry about Isaiah when it comes to that. He's really on solid ground. But my oldest son, he is one that wanted to pretend he didn't have hemophilia. He never really identified with it. He never embraced it as a part of who he was. Even to this day, and today he's 31 years old, and I try to put a separation between my mind and his life because, you know, it's just too much, and you can't remake a 31-year-old grown man, you know. So he'll call me even now sometimes. He's got something. He's got a bleed or something. He doesn't take care of himself. He doesn't have his own supply of factor. He has always been one that I would worry about going down the wrong path to manage, you know, pain, manage bleeds, because, like I said, he doesn't even keep his own supply of factor. So there has to be something. And, you know, I've tried, you know, my husband and I, we've tried to raise him right, give him the right values, keep him on a straight and narrow, everything that a good parent's supposed to do, you know, even without something like hemophilia in the family. And I just pray for him now, you know, I just pray for him, so.
Yeah, like you said, he's 31 years old. I mean, one has to take agency in one's own life at some stage or another, and you can't carry the burden of a 31-year-old's decisions.
I cannot.
For your mental health, the separation is healthy. Self-care there.
Well, as someone who has flirted with going down that wrong path in my past, to echo what you said, Stephanie, about HA&J being a soft place to land, anyone who's listening to this has a soft place to land, whether it's their local patient organization, whether it's that aunt or uncle who will always pick up the phone. And that's the hardest step is breaking that habit of going down the wrong path again and making a different decision. So know that there's a soft place to land, no matter who you are or where you are. That brings us to the end of part two from the Hemophilia and Young Adult Roundtable featuring young men with hemophilia and their champions. Again, we thank our participants for their candor. And Natalie, you know, one point that's really stuck with me from this part of the conversation was something that Janet said at the end there from a caregiver's perspective and talking about her older son and learning to accept that he's, from the sounds of it anyway, not necessarily always making healthy, smart choices.
Her line, which I think went, "You can't remake a 31-year-old grown man," was pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Obviously, the focus of this discussion is on the men with hemophilia, but it's also powerful to hear about the experiences caregivers go through as they watch their children with hemophilia transition into young adults, and as they learn how their role as caregivers transition too. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's not just the individual, but their caregiver as well that's going through a transition into young adulthood times. Our final episode, part three, goes live on bloodlinepod.com Tuesday, March 20th, and we'll focus on the topics of dating and intimacy, family, and hope. And to hold you over, here is a quick snippet from part three where Raj describes an uncomfortable interaction with his father-in-law.
I decided to agree with my wife that we'd move close to her parents, so back to where she grew up. And there's a double-edged sword there because now her parents live down the street from us, so they're quite over whenever they want, kind of thing. And, you know, when it comes to doing handy stuff around the house, like, I have a deck with a pool, which, like, requires maintenance. So this summer, my father-in-law was like, "Oh, you got to get under the deck and you got to be able to clean it out and blah, blah, blah." And I'm just like, "Do you not understand? There's sharp nails there. I have hemophilia." And he didn't.
Yeah.
And he's like, "You got to get under here." And I did. I ended up getting under there and and had to bleed. But, like, it was annoying and I was pissed off and it drew some stress.
More from our participants in part three of the Hemophilia and Young Adulthood series brought to you by Shire.
Life with a bleeding disorder can be challenging. That's why Shire created the Bleeding Disorders Community Facebook page. The BDCF, Bleeding Disorders Community Facebook page, provides useful information and an encouraging community for people living with or caring for someone who has a bleeding disorder. Visit facebook.com/bleeding disorders community today to connect with others and help take control of your bleeding disorder. Thanks for joining Natalie and I over here on Bloodline. Reminder that you will find us every month over on Bloodstream Media's flagship podcast, The Bloodstream Podcast, and we encourage you to subscribe to both on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You'll find links to subscribe to both in the program notes. That's all for now. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself.